This is an interview of Grant Lester Dunlap. We are at his home address in Carlsbad, California. The date is October 23rd, year 2000. We will be discussing his baseball career and a novel that he wrote called Kill the Umpire. And that should be able to pick you up real good from where you're at. The first thing I'd like to know is, why did they call you Snap?
Actually, a good friend of mine in basketball, of all things, started using that phrase. I was the captain of the college basketball team, and we had a coach who didn't do much, and so I exerted quite a bit of leadership. And I try to calm the guys down at certain times, you know, and at that time, I'd say, you know, things are a snap here, we're in good shape, and things like that. And so he started calling me Snap. And then when I started getting on some of the players, boy, then he'd call me the Snapper. And, of course, that seemed to last a little more, and then we played baseball together and he used it, and it sort of picked up from there, but it never picked up in wherever I played. I mean, I'd say that was my nickname and they never used it.
What college was that?
It's University of Pacific.
Oh, okay.
Then it was called College of Pacific up in Northern California, Stockton. Okay.
Talking about Stockton, what was it like growing up there as a kid during the Depression?
Well, it was a nice sized town, and you know, maybe 25,000-30,000 people, and just one high school. And when the WPA took over, helped with the parks and things, while they provided kids with equipment and playground directors, and that was a big help at that time. You had some, you know, leagues and other things before that, but you know, they didn't pick up all of the kids, you know, just a few of them. So I participated in some of those low-level sorts of things that they had. But then when the park system came in, that really helped a lot to get you through that period. It was really a very difficult period. We had a really rough time. And I wrote an article that I tried to get published in the Stockton Record about it. A kid lived across the street from me, and how his mother had been married at 12 and divorced at 13 something, and was a waitress trying to care for two kids, and having to move a lot. And the time they had to move from our neighborhood, you know, they left in the middle of the night, and they took their belongings in two old wagons, little wagons. Mm-hmm. That's all these people had. Mm-hmm. I wrote about that and how baseball really helped this kid. And he helped me because he got on teams and was a little older and stuff.
Uh-huh.
I thought it was one of the best things that I wrote, but the sports editor said, well, he can't publish things like that because he doesn't give his writers enough to write and they're not making enough money.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yeah, I had one brother and one sister. My brother was involved in track.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't play baseball.
Didn't.
No.
And how did you become interested in baseball?
Well, from a very early age, I was attracted to, I was active in balls and things. And so I'd throw balls around and things like that. And I may have seen this older kid. And my father didn't understand a dead set against, you know, anything like that. You know, he was raised on a farm. He didn't do play, that sort of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And but it was just in me, so that all of the time, especially, you know, during the summer, I was doing that. And of course, then football and basketball too.
Just about everything that there was to do, you wanted to do it. Right?
Yeah, I'm well in sports. Yeah.
Yeah. You talked in your book a little bit about the kids saving their pennies for the sporting news.
Right.
Could you say a couple things about that?
Yeah, that paper, when we first saw it and started talking about it, was just an amazing thing to us at that time, here that they covered baseball.
Uh-huh.
And so when we got tired in the early evenings and things like that, in the summer and stuff, why, we'd be talking about the different leagues and the different players and things. We didn't have pro baseball in Stockton at that time, but they had Coast League, and so that was the closest we had. And so we got so we knew the league, players, how they were hitting, and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gave you sort of a historical background from time to time, you know, about things in the major leagues and things. So it was a great, great newspaper, and I was sort of sad to see the kind of decline that has happened with it.
Yeah. Did you develop a favorite player by reading the sporting news?
Yes, and you often wonder how you pick up on some guy. One of them was a guy by the name of Nick Cullum. And I think he was playing in A or double A ball, because I think that's about as far down as you could find out much about guys. And then he came to Sacramento, I think it was in the Coast League, and it was big slugger there.
Uh-huh.
And so I followed him, and Smead Jolly was another great hitter in that era. And then we had two guys from Stockton who played in the Coast League, and one was Bob Joyce, who did pretty well in the major leagues for Philadelphia for a while. He won 30-some games in the Coast League one year. And then Bill Priest was sort of a family friend, and he got up to the big leagues, but you know, didn't stick up there. Then DiMaggio became a favorite player, because when I was old enough and at the playground, why, one of the playground directors was a baseball player at Cal, UC Berkeley, and also football. And he took me to see DiMaggio.
Uh-huh.
San Francisco.
For the Seals, right?
Right. Yeah. And he was, this guy's name was Tony Fritter, he was a big guy in my life, because he gave me a good idol. But in addition to that, why, you know, he took me to games and nurtured me and things like that.
Yeah.
So we would go and we'd get to see somebody. See, DiMaggio was a shortstop. I was playing shortstop. So that really helped along, and then he kept track of me, you know, and things like that. So that was really great, because for all practical purposes, I didn't have a father at that time. He became an idol and a father figure, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, was seeing DiMaggio at such a young age, could you see that he was going to be a great player?
Well, yeah, I was convinced that, you know, he was having a hitting streak then, I think, and that record may still stand in the Coast League. But one of the interesting things was that, see, all the kids had closed stances and their feet together at the plate, like Babe Ruth or somebody, you know, those were the guys they knew. And DiMaggio had this stance like this, where a wide stance, and he was absolutely stationary with the bat.
Uh-huh.
Nobody did that we knew of, you know. Cobb was moving his bat and moving around and all that sort of thing. So, of course, I went home and started practicing that stance, you know, trying to hit legs way spread, you know. But I actually stuck with that. So I had a wider stance than normal, and I didn't move the bat at all.
Right.
And I didn't have a hitch in my swing.
Did you play high school ball?
We didn't even have baseball in the high school, but they had Legion ball, and it was very good baseball in the summer.
Right.
So I played Legion ball, and you know, I was just a slightly above average player.
Mm-hmm. How many games a year would they play?
Well, that's the thing. We would play fewer than 20 games, you know, so it wasn't as much. But we had this great ballpark there. When they finally had pro ball, it was the same ballpark, but they played classy baseball there. And so we, you know, work out a lot before Legion ball, you know, and times like that.
Mm-hmm. You said you played basketball. Did you play basketball in high school?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in college, and I played pro 1 year. That's when they tried to have a major league of basketball in bigger cities. See, they used to play the so-called association. You know, we had teams like New York, but it also had Green Bay and Sheboygan and Oshkosh. I mean, and Tri-Cities and teams like that.
Uh-huh.
One guy created a major league with bigger cities in the north and the south.
Uh-huh.
The south was the first time, and I was in that league, but it eventually broke up because the south, you know, couldn't get interested in basketball.
Yeah. What city did you play?
I played for Birmingham, and then a guy who owned Montgomery baseball team, Class B, helped form a league of those southern cities and formed a pro basketball league. And so I stayed there with him and played the rest of the year there. And we had a very good team and won the league. He was a very interesting guy. Of all things, in the South, he was a Jewish. He owned the baseball team, and he owned the mayor, and he owned the governor.
Pretty powerful guy.
And he owned gambling, and all behind the scenes.
You said you started out as a shortstop?
Yeah.
When did you switch to the outfield?
I didn't switch until after the war. I got my ankle smashed up and had to have it operated on, and they put a screw in it, and it took a long time for rehabilitation. And after that I limped, and I lost a little of my rhythm in fielding.
Mm-hmm.
Fielding was the thing that I did best. I was a skinny kid, tall, slim, but I had a good arm and I could go in the hole, and I had good hands. And when I came back, boy, I'd been off for 3 years or so. And, you know, I played some in the service, but not much. And I couldn't play shortstop as well, so they moved me to third, and then the outfield. I started to develop more of a hitter.
Mm-hmm.
But that limping hurt me, because even when it didn't bother me anymore, you could see it when I ran a little bit. I never lost a game for it, but there were times when teams were thinking of buying me, and some passed me up and things like that because they didn't know whether that would hold up. They'd send me to specialists and stuff like that and worry about a screw still in my ankle. But the screw saved me from going back to in the Korean War, because I was in the Marine Corps, and if you had a screw in a joint, well, you couldn't go into combat. And then in Korea, they were calling me back. I wasn't in the act. I stayed in the reserve because I thought we might have war with Russia or something. I might as well stay in with my outfit.
Uh-huh.
And they called me back and gave me 5 days of training in Honolulu. And then I was to take over an infantry company in the field. Not having been in the service for 10 years, 15 years, whatever it was.
Uh-huh.
No training in combat. And they took an x-ray and saw the screw was still there, so it saved me from going over there.
Well, you got a 5-day vacation in Honolulu. Yeah,
so I didn't get get that far.
Oh, you never got
that far. That's what my orders were.
Oh, I see. Okay. Your career record said that you signed in 1941
mm-hmm.
for Riverside.
Yes.
And who were you scouted and signed, or how did that come about?
Yes, they had a tryout and in Stockton, and none of the bird dogs had recommended that I be there, but I went and asked to be included, and so they did include me. I caught the interest of the scout, Cincinnati scout, who was a professor of history, a very well-known professor at the University of California, Berkeley. And he took an interest in me, and then I played Sunday ball in Berkeley in the Winter League. And he kept watching me, and then recommended that they sign me. Frank Wayne, I guess it's Frank Wayne, was Cincinnati, and he came and looked at me and okayed it. But then that league broke up because of the war.
Uh-huh. You came back, how old were the players on that team? Were they much older than you?
Oh, yeah. Because
you were about 17 at that time?
Yeah.
How did they treat you?
It was okay. We had a good manager. He was great with me, but I don't even remember. It seemed like it was only 3 weeks or something.
Uh-huh.
And I was there because it was after school was out and the league folded.
Uh-huh.
And they sent me to Wichita to the sign. That was a terrible situation there. And one of the guys from California took an interest in me, and they had to release me technically for some reason to send me there. And then they were sure I would sign with the team. And this guy told me, don't sign with this. This is a terrible situation. And the first night I slept there in above the clubhouse, there were about 12 other guys. I mean, they all came in drunk, there were fights, you know, I was scared to death. And so I took this guy's advice and had to wire, you know, my mother for money. And I took a bus all the way home to get back home, and then I played in the shipyards. And there I attracted some interest, and the guy signed me with Cleveland the following year. And I went to Appleton with Farm.
That was a Cleveland Farm team?
Yeah.
What class was that?
D.
D. You remember any of the players on that team?
Well, Mike Garcia was a player on that team, the pitcher for Cleveland. And the scout that signed me signed him, and he asked me to take care of him because he could barely write. And he wasn't very, you know, sophisticated at all. I wasn't either, but he was in much worse shape than I was. So I used to write letters and everything for Mike, and especially fan letters and other things when there were women involved. He attracted a Mexican family once, and then when he saw the gal come to the game with her family, and she wasn't pretty and she was sort of plump, why, he wouldn't even see him after the game, and he went through a window at the clubhouse to escape. And I had to tell him that he had to go to the doctor or something, because he suddenly became, you know. But the interesting thing was is that when later on after the war, and I come up to Oklahoma City at the end of the year, Mike Garcia was there. He was completely changed. He was a good pitcher and a good competitor, but he was sophisticated. He'd been in the Army. His English was impeccable. And he carried himself with confidence. He had his teeth fixed and everything.
Uh-huh.
And I used him as a model in that book, as you know, one of the first Mexican pitchers,
uh-huh,
who really did well and who was a great, great competitor.
He sure was. I saw him pitch a number of times,
because
I'm from Cleveland.
Yeah. And yeah, I think he married some socialite or something like that.
And then he
died not too long ago.
Had some diabetes problems.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. And he was a big star in Cleveland, he sure was.
Oh, yeah.
People still talk about
him. Right.
The big beer.
The pitching staff.
Yeah.
Great.
You talked about being in the Marine Corps. How did you become an officer at such a young age?
Well, I qualified for officer's training, and then they sent me into a program called the V-12 program, which was, they sent you to college. And so I was sent to Occidental College in Los Angeles, and I was there for just a little over a year, but we took about almost 20 units, and we went to school all year round, but then we played baseball and basketball there, and so that was good. But they did that because they were trying to train more officers. They figured it's going to be a long war. And at Quantico, they couldn't take care of, you know, a whole bunch at one time, and they didn't want these 90-day wonders that the Navy and Army were doing. And so even the Navy went towards this program, too. So then they flunked out each year, 15-20%, you know, on leadership and scholastic deals. And then they sent me to pre-OCS. And there they flunked out 40%. And you were there anywhere from, 8 weeks to 12 weeks, something like that. Or maybe it was more than that. And then if you didn't make it, then you were, you know, through. And so I qualified for the first group and then went to Quantico. See, but this took a couple of years. And that helped save me from Guadalcanal and all the other things.
Uh-huh. You were stationed in China?
Yeah, then after the war, I went from Guam to China, and we repatriated the Japanese there. And then kept the railroads open for Chiang Kai-shek and all of northern China. And you know, that was quite a job. We expected all kinds of trouble from the Japanese, but once they found out, the soldiers, they found out that the emperor had surrendered, they were okay. We had no trouble at all. In fact, I used some of their troops, you know, to keep the railroad open to fight the communists, the Chinese communists.
You had more trouble with the communists than you had with the Japanese.
Yeah, so instead of risking Marines' lives, well, these guys were bored, and I'd send the sergeant, you know, that would take more than 12, 15 of his guys, and they'd go out and chase the communists away when they were trying to disrupt the railroad or something like that.
You said you played a little baseball in the service. Did you play with any major leaguers?
Well, at Occidental College, we had a college team, and then they compressed some of the leagues, so we played against SC and UCLA.
Uh-huh.
And Bobby Brown, who later came with the Yankees, and I competed with each other for the batting championship. And some other guys snuck in and beat us both. And then I played Sunday ball, which we played with mostly ex-Coast League players or guys who were, you know, had jobs, stayed out of the service.
Uh-huh.
And we played on different teams and competed against each other there. But I don't recall any real big name players that I played with. Uh-huh.
After the war, then you came out and you played a little basketball, and then you got involved again in the minor leagues, right?
Yes. And, went to Meridian. Well, they sent me to Wilkes-Barre, and then they didn't use me, and they sent me to Meridian with Class B ball.
Was that still in the Indians organization? Or?
Yes.
Because I know Wilkes-Barre was a big...
And then I had a pretty good year at Meridian, and that's when I went up to Oklahoma City at the end of the year.
What was it like playing in Oklahoma City?
I enjoyed Oklahoma City. It was a pretty good baseball town, and we had a good owner. And Cleveland seemed like a pretty good chain at that time. So, you know, I thought it was great.
What kind of instruction did you get in the Mormon Woods?
Almost none.
None.
It was just amazing. I can remember in Appleton, Wisconsin, the team was having a little trouble hitting, and the manager just read some theory on that you should hit like they do a forehand in tennis. So we had everybody try to practice having your bat level swinging down here. And so, you know, the team went right down the drain, and one of the head scouts was sent down to look, and he came and asked what's going on. He said, well, the coach, you know, the manager's making his hit this way. And he said, well, that's a bunch of rock. And he phoned and they fired the manager, and he took over. And he said, you know, forget everything he ever told you. And with a couple of us, he said, I want you to hit 3-0 all the time. Just go up, you see a good pitch, hit it. You know, that saved us the rest of the year, and we, you know, did reasonably well. Most of the teams had a manager, and even in Double A, they didn't have a coach.
Uh-huh.
Often. And so the instruction in spring training might be pretty good, but otherwise, why, it wasn't very, very good.
Did they have older players on the team that would help out or coach?
Well, it would be sort of up to a player to approach these guys for help or something.
Huh.
And then some of them were willing to do it. But a lot of times, there weren't players that were knew that much. You know, they may be fairly good players themselves, but the only thing they knew was what they did, and they didn't really, you know much. So the coaching, you know, in school wasn't that good. It wasn't that good in pro ball. I mean, some managers were better than others, but in that book, I tried to depict a manager who wasn't very good, and there were a lot of them. I had Mickey Livingston at Shreveport, and we had a good pitching staff. And Mickey was a catcher. He caught in the big leagues. And he, you know, as far as we could tell, knew very little about pitching or, you know, that much about baseball in general. He wasn't a very bright guy.
Uh-huh.
And we weren't doing well, and I had been in the league, you know, off and on for 4 years, so I was sort of a veteran in the league, and the year before I'd fought for the batting championship and ended up in the tie, but they took it to another figure and then gave it to Bob Niemann, and then this year I was leading the league hitting. And so I tried to talk to Livingston a couple times about, we've got to get these guys on a regular basis, this rotation. So these young guys, let them pitch. He'd get the rotation screwed up. And he still screwed up. So I finally posted a rotation in the bulletin. And the guys, I said, go by this, you're pitching. And then Mickey saw it, and he didn't know what to do, so we didn't do anything. And at that time, we were in seventh place, I think, and then he started letting some of these guys pitch on a regular rotation and sticking with them, and we started catching on. We got up into the first division and then won the playoffs, and we were in what they call the Dixie Series.
Uh-huh.
And that was the first time Shreveport had done that, you know, in over 10 years. And Mickey Livingston had, you know, literally nothing to do with it. I mean, it was in spite of him.
Uh-huh. Like the manager in the book, it was,
yeah,
the team was winning.
Yeah, yeah. Then there'd be other guys like Bobby Bregan, who was the greatest handling of pitchers that I ever saw. And I think part of it was he was catching them too. And that was security for these young arms. But those Dodger pitchers, you know, they'd send these hard-throwing guys down to Fort Worth. And they wouldn't be doing much. And boy, by the time he had them, you know, for 3 months or something like that, you couldn't believe how good they were.
He was a good catcher.
Very good receiver. And very sharp, sharp guy. And quite a character. He really did do a striptease in Shreveport that I saw that I used in the book. And he did compliment me on the book and saying that I one of my goals was to capture the time and the lead. And he thought that I did that well. See, later on, he became the president of that league for quite a few years. And he's written stuff himself. Still pretty active.
Huh. They say in Cleveland, though, that he put a curse on the Indians.
Yeah.
When they fired him in 1957.
Yeah,
I think he denies that, but
yeah.
As a Cleveland fan, I'm not so sure. What was your biggest thrill in the minor leagues?
I guess it was winning a batting championship after I'd lost one, so narrowly and fighting the whole time, and in the final day, the one I lost, I had the flu, and we were, you know, literally tied, and the manager was saying, you know, your best bet is, you know, not to try to play, and the odds are you probably win it, and I couldn't do it that way, so I played. And I had a couple hits, and then I was feeling pretty weak, and he suggested that I should do it, you know, 2-for-4 or something like that. Well, I'd be darned if Neiman didn't do the same thing, but he had fewer at-bats or something, and so that put him over the edge. So when I did win it and then felt part of the leadership of that team, why those two things were thrills in my age.
When you win a batting title in the minor leagues, do they give you anything?
No.
Nothing.
No.
Pat on the back. Huh? What type of hitter were you? A slap hitter?
No, I was a line drive hitter, and when I first started in pro ball, I weighed 138, and I didn't have a lot of power, but I could hit line drives and for doubles and triples and things like that. So I wasn't exclusively a singles hitter. And then, as I filled out more and got so I pulled the ball a little better. I hit up the middle into the opposite field more, and as I learned how to pull the ball more, and they kept saying, hey, it's okay to hit 300, but you got to show some power to get up to the big leagues. That's what the scouts were telling me. And so then I worked on that, and then, you know, got so that I was up around 20 home runs if you And sometimes I'd be someplace else for a while and then back to the Texas League or something like that. So I had reasonably good power.
What kind of stadiums were you playing in?
Well, some of them were just, you know, absolutely terrible. Beaumont was just the dregs of, you know, literally the earth, town and everything else about it. And so the ball fields were terrible. Some of the lighting was, you know, really bad. Beaumont was another example of that. Shreveport was not good at all. Fort Worth had the most modern stadium. It was had been recently modernized, and it was a beautiful facility, very well maintained, and stands and everything. That was an exception. Tulsa was an older place, but they maintained it well. So that was good, and Dallas was pretty good. Oklahoma City was just fair, and Houston was, you know, probably a little above average, but I mean, the lights and the fields and the clubhouses, I tried to tell how some, you know, one of the clubhouses went, you know, bare floors, splinters, there, almost no lights, no training room to speak of, you know, no trainer really. You had a clubhouse guy, and he sort of filled in as a trainer. And the most they ever have is a heat lamp. And so, you know, guys were just on their own.
You were talking about your hitting stance before. Did you keep that up in the minor leagues?
Yeah. So.
Well, when you made it to, how did you get from the Indians organization to the St. Louis Cardinals?
To think of how that I was drafted by one of the teams, and it was I think a Yankee AAA team, and so that got me out of that organization. And then they didn't keep me, and so Shreveport bought me from them. Mm-hmm.
And Shreveport was a
independent.
It was independent. And did you go to spring training with the Cardinals in '53?
Yeah.
And made the team out of spring training?
Or? Yes.
You wore number 10 for the Cardinals.
Uh-huh.
Did you wear number 10 during your minor league career? Or?
No, I don't even know how I got that number. Probably it was one that was left or something.
Okay.
Like that. One of the interesting things that happened in spring training was that against good pitching, and we trained with the Yankees there in St. Petersburg, where Bilko wasn't hitting well at all, and I had been mostly an outfielder, but I saw that, so I started working out at first base, and then played a couple games there, and then I was hitting really well, and so Stanky told me the job is yours. So you can, you know, you can handle this pitching a lot better than Coco. The next day, I'm caught in a run down the field is wet between first and second when I was trying to keep out of a double play. And Joe Adcock was running when I toward second base, which he shouldn't have been doing. And I fell, and he tried to jump over me, and he landed right on my ankle and spiked the heck out of me. And the thing got infected. They sewed it up and everything, but it got infected. So I wasn't able to play for a week and started going north and playing against minor league teams, and Bilko hit one home run after another. And then Stanky said he's going to be the National League Babe Ruth. And so that finished my time chance there.
Did you have any superstitions?
Well, not steady ones, you know, like some people would have. They wouldn't cross the line, or they'd put their glove or something like that. But I. That day, why I'd go back the next day sometimes and try to do the same thing.
Uh-huh. After spring training, you made it to St. Louis. How did the other players accept you?
Oh, yeah, that was one thing that I wanted to be sure to mention to you was that Musial and Chandish were two great players, but they were also two great people. And they would both go out of their way, a rookie or something, to try to help, you know, them feel welcome and stuff. Musial, two or three days into spring training, told me, hey, anytime you want to use my CAD, just let me know. And, you know, there'd be no way. I'd be scared to death to try to drive his Cadillac, but that's the way he was. And he went out of his way the whole year. And once when I'd hit a triple to win a game in the Polo Grounds, why Stanky said, well, you finally get to deserve to start. And Musial was there, and he says, hey, put this guy hitting fourth. I'd like to have him hit behind me. And we rained out the next day, and he put Bilko back in, and wouldn't discuss it with me. And that started, you know, my demise as far as he was concerned, because I contested him, you know, in a nice way at first, and then when he wouldn't answer anything, I challenged him. You said you were going to do this. I deserve it. Because on that trip I'd gotten home run in Cincinnati, I'd gotten two hits in Brooklyn, I'd gotten a triple in the Polo Grounds, and then we were fighting for a pennant, and Bilko was hitting 240. But Musial was great, and he was a very interesting guy. He handled fame better than anybody I've ever seen in anything. How he treated people and things like that. He's a very interesting guy loved music. He was always playing. He didn't play the harmonica then, but he'd be banging on chairs and stuff. And he was an amateur magician who loved to do tricks, you know, when we're on the train or something like that, card tricks and other sorts of things. But he was a great guy, and those two guys were great friends, too. A lot of times, guys who were really good ball players, they're competing against, you know, sometimes your own teammates and things like that, and they're phony. You know, they talk behind people's back and things like that. These two guys were great friends, and they were both great guys. They had a lot of guts, too, especially Red. One day in Brooklyn, it's hotter than heck, a day game, and Stanky keeps going out to the mound. Things aren't going well. And this one time, third time he'd done it in the game, Red just came in the dugout and sat down. He says, well, he's going to be out there for 5 minutes. I might as well get in the shade. Well, he didn't say a word to him. And when we used to have room check, I'd ask them, I says, now, did they check your, did, you know, he had the coach check your room? Oh, no. They didn't check their room at all.
Would they check your room in spring training and into the season, or?
Yes, sporadically.
Uh-huh.
You know, if we lose a game or two, Stanky would then he'd check rooms and, you know, and try to get somebody help. He was a good baseball man, and, you know, thinking ahead and moves and stuff like that, his mind was always active. But he didn't know people at all. He couldn't handle people at all. He couldn't handle a team and how to do it. Now, DeRocher was a little like him, but DeRocher knew how to handle a team. When things were going badly, he'd back off. And then when they start, and then he'd say, hey, don't worry, you know, we're going to come out of it. He had this gambler's instinct. He was a big gambler. And he'd say, you know, we're going to get hot. And then when they'd get hot and they were going well, you know, he'd keep pushing, but not in a negative way. Hey, we've got to keep it up. We've got to keep it up. And he'd get teams, you know, well, that Giants, that 1 year, you know, that won, you know, 17 straight games or something like that to catch the Dodgers. Well, that was because he was brilliant at that sort of thing. Stanky was just the opposite. When the team wasn't doing well, he'd jump all over the guys that didn't matter. And didn't know how to do it, so he was, you know, on balance was a poor manager. While on balance, you know, DeRocher, with all his faults, was quite a good one. But there was a difference. And I can remember guys Stanky ruined. One guy by the name of Mike Clark, who was a promising pitcher. He and Harvey Haddix were two great rookies, and Mike Clark was a wicked sidearm right-hand, big, tall, strong throwing guy. And in Brooklyn, he got a little wild. Stanky goes out there, he's facing Campanella, and he tells him, he walked the guy before, you can't walk another hitter, you're out of it. Then he tells him, you can't give Campanella anything good to hit. And so you've got to throw the breaking ball down in your way, you know, and then pitch him tight in here off the plate, but don't walk him. So this poor Mike is out there, you know, he's petrified. But, and so the next pitch hits the grandstand. And before it's through, you know, he chewed him out, called him a gutless, this and that, and everything else. He was never, you know, he never recovered. Harvey Haddix didn't have that, but he had no more talent. He became a great pitcher. Mike drifted and didn't hit this. You know, he started a few games, and that was, you know, the end of his major league career.
You said you hit a home run in Cincinnati. That was your only major league home run?
Yes, yeah.
And you remember who you hit it off
of? Raffensperger, I think, the left-handed pitcher.
Did you hit left-handers better than right-handers? Or?
Not, especially not at first, because I hadn't seen that many left-handers. I hit more home runs off of right-handers. I think it's always easier because they hang breaking pitches. Those are pitches, you know, that are home run pitches. And with the left-handed, the fastball's tailing away from it. It's a little harder, you know, to pull the ball. But I got so I could hit them really well.
When you hit the home run, did it help win the game?
I don't think so. The triple against the Giants did. Remember that? I had two interesting things happen against Brooklyn. I hit a really hard line drive against the left center field wall, or on skip. And we were behind in the game, but it was going to be an easy double, you know, so the coaches waved me on, and I'm going for second base. But it came right to Duke Snyder, and he had a much better arm than people give him credit for. He threw an absolute perfect throw to second base, and I was out. And then I hit one on the screen in St. Louis, in right field, and I guess it was Dixie Walker who was coaching. It was an easy double, and Dixie was so afraid because of the last time that he held me at first base. So I would have had a home run, a triple, and a couple extra doubles if and just pinch hitting. Snyder hadn't made such a good play, and then Dixie Walker had been afraid to send me on an obvious double.
When you hit the home run, what were you thinking as you were rounding the bases? If you can remember that.
Yeah. Well, it was one of those things where you almost feel as if you're running on air, you know, that it's an unreal sort of thing. It was not an easy park to hit in left center field. You really had to hit the ball well. And I really did hit that ball well. And then, you know, after the game, it just kept building up. I couldn't sleep that night, you know, just the thought that, God, this is going to help me, you know, and I did this, so.
Was that at Sportsman Park? Or?
No, that was on the road.
At Crosby Field?
Yeah, Crosby Field.
That was an interesting ballpark, Crosby Field.
Yeah.
I had the chance to see a game down there from 1968 or so, and that was certainly interesting. You've talked about some of the members of the 53 Cardinals. What was Enos Slaughter like?
Well, Slaughter was a strange combination of guys. He was a dumb ball player. Couldn't get the signs. They had to give him special signs. And you always had excuses. But instinctively, well, he was pretty good, and he always hustled. And he had one of the, you know, nicest, simplest swings you want to see. And amazingly, at that time, he took really good care of himself. I mean, he took a nap every afternoon. He didn't drink much. He watched his food and everything. And he wasn't popular with the players. He wasn't unpopular, but he wasn't popular. And most players were always talking about his wives or ex-wives, and how he'd get rid of them. They even claimed that he tried to shove one of them out the door when they went around a curve. But, you know, I think that was his third wife, and he'd always threatened them, and he had a judge that handled the divorces where those women didn't get hardly a thing.
Wow. Did you make any friends from that team or from the minor league teams that you kept in contact with?
There were a few guys. Most of them weren't from California, so that, you know, keeping in contact with them, there were guys like, Billy Klaus was a guy where we had played together in Dallas and then in Minneapolis. Was a good friend. And a guy by the name of Fred Marsh, who got up to the big leagues for a little while, was a good friend. And Ransom Jackson and I were pretty close, and the guy I liked a lot was Herb Conyers that I mentioned in the book, who was by far the greatest minor league hitter I ever saw, better than Al Rosen. They hadn't tried to change his hitting all the time. He would have been a great major league star.
You talked about people trying to change him. Did you see a lot of that where scouts would come in and say, you have to bat this way?
Yeah, and a lot of times, it was completely wrong, the things they were saying. By that time, I knew that I wanted to be a coach or a manager. I had a chance to be a player manager in Shreveport, but by that time I decided to settle down with my family. Baseball and settled in coaching, so I went to college coaching. But I don't know, so I sort of lost my train there. What were you asking?
Coaches and managers trying to change things.
I was going to bring this example about Muzio. He's in the worst slump in his major league career. And he'd had a coach, Buzzy Wares, who would watch him, and if he's doing something different, he'd tell him. And Buzzy wasn't there anymore. So Stanky decided he'd work with him. And he wanted to change his stance. And how far away from the plate it stood. And so Musial listened to him and said, okay, I'll work on it, Skip. And then said, why in the world should I change my stance? So I had good rapport with him. And, he knew I studied baseball. I was picking guys' brains. A lot of pitchers there, because when I was going to coach, you had to know a lot about that. And he says, okay, you remember how I was hitting in spring training? I says, yeah. Do you see anything different? And I said, no, I don't, honestly. Okay, but watch me more carefully in these next two or three games. If you don't see anything, don't say it. If you see something, first game I didn't notice him. The second game, twice I noticed that when he was getting just about hit, his head just went up a fraction. it, because his head usually just stayed down. And when he did that, he was popping balls up. See, this is what he'd been doing. So after the game, I said, gee, I think I saw something. And I think you were just lifting your head just slightly. So you weren't pulling your head off, just lifting. Went out the next day in batting practice, and he said, yep, that's it. And then, when he was hitting 240 at the break, at the All-Star break, and he still ended up hitting over 300. Just an incredible thing. But the there was sometimes no coaching or over-coaching, you know, or coaching when, you know, it was really stupid. What, instead of Stanky trying to see what he was doing differently, or by then they had some movies that they could have looked at. No, he's going to tell them. Stanky was never a good hitter. I mean, he just waited for a walk and foul pitches off until he laid one down in the middle of the plate, you know.
Uh-huh.
And, but that's a good example of that. Now it's so much more advanced in kind of coaching and videos and things that they can see.
These guys videotape everything and watch it.
You can do too much of that, too.
Yeah, I think you might be right. So. And you kind of mentioned that you were thinking about getting into coaching even back in the early 50s. And you kind of hung on until about 55 in the minor leagues. Were you going to school in the off season? And
some of those I did do that and worked on a teaching credential. So I did that. And then actually, when I decided to quit, the next year in the summer, I had a chance to go play ball and I'm in double A and I didn't want to. And the following year, Birmingham phoned me up. They needed a right-hand hitter. And they asked him, had you been playing ball and everything? And, you know, you're coaching, so you're up there taking batting practice every day and stuff like that. No, I hadn't been taking batting practice and things like that. You don't, you have so much limited time with the players at a good academic institution that you don't waste time up there at the plate. But I went out, drove there in 2.5 days and played that night a game when I hadn't played a game in 2 years. Mm-hmm. And played in the Southern Association. Ralph Terry was on that team. A lot of good young ball players and managed to hit 300. I was pretty proud of that.
So after your baseball career, you went to Occidental?
Yeah.
And what did you teach?
It was in physical education, and I started off just teaching activities, you know, tennis, golf, and stuff like that. And then gradually, they had a very academic physical education major when they did the city exams for teachers in that field, why Occidental College would have more than SC and UCLA combined in the top 10. And so then they started having me teaching what considered academic courses, methods in coaching to start with, and then I was teaching the history of sports, going into that, and then gradually expanding into other things and motor learning, psychology of learning, psychology of sports, and then even in the general program, you know, history of civilization, I taught writing and history there for a short period, but I also had to do the athletic director at different times and chairman and all of those things. So I coached basketball for 15 years and I had to give that up because of all of those things. But
did you teach, were you coaching the baseball team too?
Yeah, I coached the baseball team for 30 years. Huh. I was the only coach that ever became a full professor there.
How many games a year would they play?
When I was first there, we played about 17. It wasn't like some of the bigger schools. And then gradually we started increasing it. So by the time that I finished, well, you know, we were playing 25 to 30 games. But now I think they're playing closer to 40
games. Some of these California schools play over 100.
Oh yeah, right.
A lot of games.
Yeah.
How many players would you have on a team?
Well, I would have as few as 15 sometimes, and later on, I might have 20, something like that. Rarely over that.
Did they give out scholarships?
No, they had no athletic scholarships in the conference. That's a conference with Pomona and Redlands and Whittier and Caltech and things. And they used to consider it the Ivy League of the West. Huh. Higher academic standards and no athletic scholarships. And it was, they were scholarships based on need. So parents had to fill out this whole thing, and then it showed there was a need. Why, then they would help some of those students. But it made recruiting pretty difficult against schools that gave athletic scholarships.
Yeah, I think it would be very hard. So I think. Can you tell me why you wrote the book Kill the Umpire?
Well, my daughter is an English lit major at Oxy and a baseball fan, and we would, if we'd hear of a novel, a baseball novel, we'd let one another know or we'd get it and exchange it. And I'd always complain that they never get the baseball part right. These guys talk to so-called experts, or they play a little ball, but invariably they're just mistake after mistake after mistake made about strategy, coaching, almost everything about the inside portion of playing baseball, and even what happens. And so I'd always complain, and she says, you've got to write a book on that yourself. I'll edit it for you. Once when I had a sabbatical, because of her urging, why I had started to write a novel completely different. And a novel that I think would have sold, because it was set in Los Angeles and it was the Dodgers and an unusual guy. Young pitcher, And I'd gotten a rough copy of that darn thing, and then when I moved to here, well, I inadvertently threw the thing out. And I just didn't have the heart to try to, you know, to redo it. And my short-term, I have a good short-term memory, but not a very good long-term memory. And it, I felt, was, you know, a really good book. And then my daughter kept asking me to write something again, and I had written a short story once about the Texas League, and then I found that and said, maybe I can make this into, I didn't like it, it wasn't very good, and I can make this into a novel. So I said, okay, I'll try it. And I want the baseball part to be right, and I want to try to capture this, what I think is the golden era before all the changes in baseball, in the minor leagues, and get the feel for that. And I didn't spend the time and effort that I did with the other book at all, you know, because there were a lot of, was more involved, a lot longer than everything. I said, this is going to be a short book to my daughter. And so I whipped it out. Then, of course, I had to self-publish it. And part I didn't like, but, you know, afterwards, you know, trying to figure out, you know, how to sell the damn thing and stuff like that. And my wife had all kinds of health problems, and so I wasn't able to promote it. I had one lousy idea that I thought was a good idea, that if I could get that into the ballpark, you know, where fans really are, that it would really sell. And the ballparks would like it. Well, I went to a few of the ballparks, and the people that you talk to there, who handle the stuff that they're selling in those stores, none of them have ever read a book, let alone a baseball book. I was amazed at these people, that they didn't know of any books. They didn't know of any of the history. They didn't know about Withers, the glory of their times, or, you know, anything like that. They had none of the books in there. And that was, I figured, was going to be my entree, and that was a bad idea. It didn't work at all. It is on Amazon, and that sells a few books. It got pretty good reviews on Amazon. Then in Stockton, one of the bookstores carried it, sold it.
Did you ever meet an umpire like Dutch Foster?
Yeah. Yeah, there was a guy in, well, I, you know, not, there weren't that many that exactly like him, but it's like personalities. You find, you know, most of the policemen are good, but you find some of them who go there for the wrong reasons, and they, you know, they cause a lot of problems. And then some of the umpires, as I've said in the book, think the people go to see them. And you can see the arrogance of the umpires, and they want to decide in the American League where the strike zone is.